breeding for disease resistance in cotton, a smaller business perspective.
Thanks, Jason. First of all, I wanted to thank all the earlier speakers. That's kind of been great to hear from some of the other business perspectives on techniques you're using to advance disease resistance. Kind of hard to refocus on my perspective on that. A lot to think about there. Jason approached me a few months ago to talk about how a small private business approaches breeding for disease resistance as possibly being a different approach than some of the other companies and speakers you've heard from today who aside from Dr. Borland, are going to be global companies with a little bit different set of resources available and to throw at disease issues in cotton. So my talk's going to be similar to our approach. It's going to be simple and a lot shorter. So that's probably a good analogy. My name's Tom Brooks. I'm Director of Research at AmeriCot. And this morning, I think a lot of what explains what we do at AmeriCot is obvious when you see what kind of our build, what our company is, and it kind of makes everything flow from flows from that. So I'll briefly talk about AmeriCot as a company and who we are, how that impacts our research budget and focus, how that relates to disease resistance breeding in particular, and possibly touch on some of the other technologies that are out there. AmeriCot strictly sells cottonseed in the U.S. We have no other income streams, no other crops. We are a cottonseed company only, and pretty much limiting our seed sales in the United States. We do cover a majority of the cotton belt, with the exception of California, and this is a little bit out of date kind of sales regions that we cover. We do sell seed in Arizona as well. Our company is not very big. We have pretty much roughly about 16 employees total, and most of those by necessity need to be your sales reps. So by you do the math on two-thirds of those being sales reps, and that doesn't leave very many people for a research program. We're based in West Texas in the Lubbock area, and that's where our strength in sales and adaptability has been in the past. We currently are planting on about 20% of the acres in Texas, about 12% belt-wide. So we have grown in recent years further east with more competitive varieties in those areas and see that as an area of growth in the future. So I mentioned I'm director of research, and that means at AmeriCot that I'm also chief hoe hand and chief research administrator, chief, I'm the one who gets to grease the cotton picker sometimes. So it covers a little bit of everything. So personnel is one of the biggest challenges we have. Been very fortunate in the past year to bring on Dr. Ken Leger, and he's kind of helping. He's kind of a teammate for me now. I'm really excited to have him on board because he's involved with this too. But it's oftentimes my responsibility spread over a lot of things. So how do you utilize your time and resources most effectively? And the same thing goes for financial. We don't have a large amount of resources to throw at a specific problem. Therefore, our equipment, buildings, labs, and stuff like that are also limited. And what that leads me to is obviously I have to outsource a lot of work, and that is just to cover my bases, that's a necessity for me. And partnering with other companies for things we financially can't do, such as bring our own glyphosate resistance gene to market, it's not financially feasible for us to do that. So we partner with people like Monsanto for their technology genes, and they've been very open in partnering with us to do that. So it's something we have to do and to move forward and stay competitive in the cotton industry in the U.S. So how does this relate to this council this morning in disease resistance? It's really, I think my best defense for it is my best return on investment oftentimes is working on disease resistance issues in cotton as far as making improvements in a variety we sell or germplasm we have. My time is more efficiently use working on these disease issues, thanks to a lot of times the protocols you guys have developed. Dr. Borland was mentioned several of those today, and so I rely on those public protocols that have been published and different programs that allow screening, which I'll mention in a minute, some of those. So it works well on a small scale when I'm doing them in-house too. Oftentimes you can, some of the other speakers mentioned some very large programs they have to address these issues. There's really no top end to what you can do. But at the same time, even small projects can be very effective on certain disease issues that are in cotton. And this tends to work well with a lot of the people we are able to cooperate with, both public and some private research cooperators that we can work with. They can take data for us, or they have expertise. A lot of the public people we work with have expertise in certain disease issues. So we want to, you know, I'm always looking for that expertise, but because my training is generally in molecular breeding. That's my background. Occasionally I get to do classical breeding. A lot of times I'm shuffling everything. I feel more like an administrator most of the time now. So I get to zero in occasionally, but at the same time I need to rely on expertise from other people where I can efficiently use our resources and use their expertise at the same time. And that helps me cover more bases and to try to stay competitive in the breeding program. So again, why is this important to my breeding program? Well, that disease resistance that we've been talking about, and I think Dr. McPherson mentioned this earlier, and is that yield stability. I personally think is a very important factor. If you look at the most popular varieties in the U.S. Now or any time in the last 10 years, that yield stability is a key trait that is important. And I think there's a very strong relationship between that and the inherent disease package that comes with that variety. And so to me, not only is it more efficient in my time and effort to pinpoint certain disease issues, I think that helps me improve the stability out just overall of my germplasm, because I don't like surprises. And I know somebody mentioned earlier, actually it was Dr. McPherson's bronze wilt was a very good example of that. And another way of saying this that Ken mentioned to me when we were talking about this earlier this week is it's not necessarily that I want resistance to bronze wilt, but I don't want susceptibility to bronze wilt. And that's the big, you don't want those surprises. I thought that was a good way to look at it. So just briefly, some of the areas that we do consistently focus on, I just kind of broke these up, and it's not exhausted by any means. Some of the things that we continually have a program in place for at least a semi-annual or multi-generational within a year. Programs to address would be things like blight resistance, verticillium wilt tolerance in our nurseries, annual, where we have screening programs in place, both nematode, root knot and reniform nematode screens, and seedling disease issues. These are things we take data on essentially all plots and have specific experiments set up to address. And in both these, in all these cases, we do some of this in-house, but we also rely heavily on cooperators. For example, Dr. Wheeler graciously will kill half my nursery for me anytime I ask her to with bacterial blight, and some of our reniform nematode work and root knot nematode work. We also have outsourced screening for those, both in greenhouse and in field, but a lot of the other diseases that we've heard of, talked about, or occasionally pop up, which I kind of label as secondary diseases. Oftentimes I have to look at those as just opportunistic types of breeding opportunities, where if I happen to have a nursery in South Georgia that got rained on for 8 weeks straight in the fall and I have a good boll rot opportunity to rate for bull riding, then I'll take ratings on that and incorporate that data into my knowledge of the of my germplasm, but it may not be something I do on a regular basis. So it's just kind of more of an opportunistic type example, and I'll get into one of those as a final example. One of the things that happened to me this year is we lost one of our primary nurseries right outside of Lubbock. I think it just missed you guys, Megan, north of me, but it wiped me out. About June the 25th, you couldn't even tell I had cotton planted in the field after the hailstorm, and it was too late for me to replant in Lubbock. So I didn't have the resources available to plant in my Yuma, you know, sister internal location, or, you know, in Argentina or somewhere like that, because I don't have a location in Yuma. So I made some phone calls to, I know Dr. David Drake and Dr. Mike Minzenmeyer in South Texas around the San Angelo area, who both graciously tried to work into their field areas, a place for me to plant some of my nursery late this summer or this spring. We ended up planting with Dr. Rick down near San Angelo. And this is a picture I put in, taken in late August of that field. It should be post-peak bloom. It's not. In fact, about 50% of those plots, they don't even have a single fixed position on them. So this was planted in late June, almost July the 1st, and had very good rain events throughout the summer. And I barely harvested cotton off half these plots in November. And Mike was very apologetic for it, but the reason I put this up for you guys is we were very ecstatic to have this plot because it is through the roof for reniform nematode pressure. And just so happened, we didn't even know that when we got on the field. But we were able to plant populations there that were segregating for some of that, some potential tolerance for that. And that's, so this was an example of an opportunistic disease-related data set that I can move forward with and actually kind of build off of this coming year. And so it just kind of worked out just kind of fortuitously, I guess you'd say. So my takeaway for kind of what I wanted to talk about today was the importance to me, the importance to me of and our company of collaborating both with the public programs as well as some private cooperators across the U.S. in addressing, in particular, disease-resistant issues to improve our germplasm. It's very important for us. I do hope that the programs in Arkansas, Dr. Borland, and some of the other states would keep that in mind. At least from our perspective, it's very significant for us that those are maintained. It does have a big impact on what I can do to advance our material. And just you've seen some just fantastic examples this morning of the power of some of the new technologies being used, molecular related advances in resistance to whether it's breaking linkage drag with the different nematode complexes or even addressing something as quantitative as vert resistance. The cost of doing that has gone down drastically in the last few years to the point where it's getting to where I can even consider using some of these tools. And so we're in transition of doing a lot lower, smaller scale than what's been mentioned today, but it is benefiting my program as well. And I do want to mention that there's been some big public efforts to make that possible, such as the International Gene Chip Consortium that was available this year. Made available this year, and so there's been some great efforts that I'm excited about, and see that changing how I do interact with a small program. And just as a since there's supposed to be some pathologists in this room, instead of a pretty picture at the end, I'll just have a bunch of ugly pictures. These are things that we ran into in my nurseries and test plots this year. Only one of these is actually a disease. But if you don't know your disease problems very well, you might assume some of these others were. And so it's key to know that anyway. And just to close, of course, the bottom left picture is bacterial blight that was kind of that was native to a test plot we happen to have in Chillicothe this year, Terry, and no inoculation needed. And the second, the middle picture is actually heat shock from a field that didn't quite get irrigated in time, and it flared all the top bowls in like 2 days' time. So it, no insect damage or anything there. It's just abiotic. And the third picture, which we've seen a lot in the southern plains of West Texas the last few years. Anybody got a guess as to what that is? That is it's sand related, but it's driven by prowl H2O damage in conjunction with sand damage from the wind at the base of the stalk with a hot dose of prowl H2O. So and you'll see stalks break over till harvest, you know, just throughout the summer. So anyway, that's my talk, and thanks for your time.
Any questions? Time for questions? Okay, I think all the speakers have held over. I appreciate your presentation.